Today at Reader's Corner, Lawrence Goldstone, author of Birdmen, The Wright Brothers, Glenn Curtis, and The Battle to Control the Skies. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In May of 1912, Wilbur Wright died in his own bed in the family home in Dayton, Ohio. He was 45 years old. The cause of death was typhoid fever, which he may have contracted from eating tainted clam broth at a Boston restaurant. But Orville Wright and members of the Wright family believed Wilbur's death was attributable to the stress he experienced fighting their archenemy and main competitor, Glenn Curtis. In Orville Wright's mind, Curtis had killed his older brother. Lawrence Goldstone tells the story of the Wright brothers' battle with Curtis in the early years of manned flight in his book Birdmen. Birdmen is also about the birth of modern aviation and the intrepid inventors and aviators who dedicated and sometimes risked their lives to solve what was called the flying problem. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Lawrence Goldstone. He is the author or co-author of 14 books of fiction and nonfiction. Birdmen is now out in paperback. Mr. Goldstone joins us via Skype for this interview. Lawrence Goldstone, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob.
Lawrence, it's great to have you with us, and let's begin with an overview of this book in the context of current times. I subscribe to a magazine called Fast Company, which is all about technology, all about innovation. I work in higher education where you can't open up the Chronicle of Higher Education any day of the week without reading about innovation and creativity and all the new things we're either doing or we ought to be doing. And here you are taking us back to the very early part of the 20th century, reviewing with us the fact that at least as far as the Wilbur and Orville Wright story is concerned, it isn't the first case of where innovation is messy, it's competitive. Innovators themselves can be weird birds, not exactly organization men. They in some ways thrive on the failure of others. Today we look at Steve Jobs as this very enigmatic personality and character that's generated at least two biographies so far. But in a way, you tell us this is nothing new. Steve Jobs is just the latest to come along in a long line of innovators, and Wilbur and Orville may be some of the best examples of that. Help us understand that.
Well, I saw a movie when I was younger called Back to the Future, and the books I choose to write about in history are kind of back to the present. I'm looking for incidents and problems in history that reflect on current times. And if you look carefully, you see that all sorts of processes repeat, and innovation is definitely one of them. Mm-hmm. By the way, I have a book coming out next May on early automobile technology called Drive, about Henry Ford. And Henry Ford and Steve Jobs are so eerily similar, it's absolutely spooky. In terms of the Wright brothers, though, what I found was that the mythology that grew up around them is extremely misleading, and that they're much more complex human figures than they're generally given credit for or written about. And that when you look at them as they were, first of all, they were two very different people. Wilbur was absolutely brilliant, and Orville was a terrific craftsman, and they did not get along idyllically. But what they did in the process of innovation, absolutely brilliant to come up with the first flying machine, the first machine that could do controlled powered flight. But from that period forward, on December 17th, 1903, after that, although he was entreated by some of the richest men in America, Wilbur Wright never produced another single innovation. And today, there is no element of the Wright brothers' airplane that is part of modern aviation, whereas Glenn Curtis, the list is pages long.
And we'll talk about Glenn Curtis in a moment, but take us back to Kitty Hawk on December 17th, 1903. I think what we can all remember from our early American history books is the photo, which you have in your book, of the plane, actually the flyer, as they called it later, taking off. But tell us about that flight specifically. What's the statistics there?
Well, the irony was that the first person in the air was supposed to be Wilbur. Wilbur was definitely the big brother in every. He was older, but he was the big brother in more than just chronologically. And on December 14th, Wilbur had taken off. They agreed to take turns. And there was a minor malfunction in their wing warping, which is how they control the aircraft, and it went into the sand. So on December 17th, it was Orville's turn. And so we see the picture of Orville Wright. He made four flights that day. It is the culmination, December 17th, 1903, was the culmination of a seven-year investigation, building, and testing by first Wilbur. Orville did not join the effort until 1900, till the first trip to Kitty Hawk. But Wilbur, who never graduated high school, was completely self-taught, never had an engineering course, read, learned, and had the kinds of epiphanies we generally associate with the great instinctive scientist like Einstein. He discovered lots of other people were investigating flight. It was like Gutenberg. Lots of people were investigating how to print with movable type, but Gutenberg was the one who did it. Lots of people were investigating powered control flight, but Wilbur was the one who did it. And for that, we owe him an absolute debt.
And explain the specific innovation that he brought to flight, the warping of the wings. What's that mean?
Well, there were two inventions that were used as paradigms for flight. And one was the automobile, and the other, amazingly enough, was the bicycle. And when the safety bicycle, that's with the two wheels of the same size, was introduced in the 1880s, there was probably no product ever introduced in America, including the iPhone, that was more popular faster than the bicycle. Tens of millions were sold, and this is in a country of 70 million people, tens of millions were sold over the next decade. And most of the people investigating flight said, well, we want a plane that flies like a car. You kind of drive it around the sky, kind of flat. Wilbur recognized that when you ride a bicycle and you make a turn, you have to bank the bicycle or you end up on the ground. And he realized that in order to fly, you need to bank the airplane. And he created a system whereby his right flyer was inherently unstable. If left alone, it would spin and crash. But he noticed from watching birds that they control themselves by one wingtip going up, the other wingtip going down. And he created a cable and pulley system where his wings, one set would go up and one set would go down. And that would both right the airplane in flight and allow it to turn with a bank. So no one had ever done that. And that was the major breakthrough that allowed controlled powered flight.
Mm-hmm. So once they got this flyer up into the air, why did they fail at getting into the U.S. marketplace ahead of others?
Oh, they didn't fail at all. They chose not to. Wilbur and Orville were absolutely straightforward and honest. The correspondence is filled with what they wanted to do. And what they wanted to do was to create a monopoly. Monopoly was very big and popular back in the early 1900s. Create a monopoly whereby they would collect a 20% royalty, not just on airplanes that used wing warping, but that on every airplane that subsequently went into the skies. And they were absolutely open about this. So they went from Kitty Hawk, they went back to Dayton, and instead of publicizing their invention, they hired a patent lawyer, a man named Harry Tolman. And for the next 4 to 5 years, they didn't fly publicly. And then they were testing it out in Huffman Prairie near their homes, but the only people watching were beekeepers and farmers. And it was only when other aviators began to solve the flying problem on their own, Glenn Curtis among them, that the Wrights, having gotten their patent in 1906, began to fly publicly. And by 1909, they were suing everyone in sight.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Lawrence Goldstone, author of Birdmen, The Wright Brothers, Glenn Curtis, and The Battle to Control the Skies. So let's move over to Glenn Curtis. Tell us about the roots of the feud. I guess it goes back to 1906 when they first met. Is that when they actually first met?
Yeah, Glenn Curtis was a young prodigy. He was very much temperamentally, he and Wilbur Wright were very, very similar, which could have been why they disliked each other so much. Curtis started also with bicycles. He was a bicycle racer. Then he moved up to motorcycles, which had just been invented, like in, say, 1895. He was a mechanical genius. He built his own motors and by the early 1900s was building the best lightweight, efficient motors in the world. He would mount those on bicycle frames, and he said in 1907, he set a speed record of 136 miles an hour on a kind of a glorified motorized bicycle. He went into flying because another unbelievable character. One thing about this period, there was one amazing character after another. It was so much fun to write about. It was just head shaking. Someone named Thomas Scott Baldwin, who invented the flexible parachute. And Baldwin wanted to create a steerable balloon, a dirigible, in the early 1900s. He stumbled on a Curtiss motor on a motorcycle. He ordered one. It worked. He subsequently went to meet Curtiss. And he and Curtiss collaborated on dirigibles. And in 1906, in September of 1906, they went to a fair in Ohio, and the Wright brothers were present. And remember, the Wright brothers, no one had seen them fly publicly. People were calling them frauds. In Europe, they were known as bluffeurs because no one believed they had actually flown because they refused to show. They were trying to sell the airplane, but they refused to demonstrate it first. So they met when one of Baldwin's balloons got loose and the Wrights helped them pull it in. And they went and they had a meeting in the Wright shop. And subsequently, the Wrights claimed that they told Curtiss about their ideas, which is somewhat unlikely because they weren't telling anybody. And Curtiss stole them. And Curtiss said that they had spoke just generally and he got nothing. All he was trying to do was sell motors to the Wrights to put on the Wright flyer. And that's also a bit unlikely because Curtiss from very quickly there on started experimenting with flight very successfully. Now, Curtiss was a really smart guy. Maybe he did. But it is probable that the truth lies somewhere in between, that the Wrights did not give away the secrets of what they did, but gave enough information on how to fly that it sent Curtiss off to experiment on his own.
And as I remember reading the book, the Wrights were convinced that they owned this what I guess you refer to as lateral stability, which is the innovation that's the wingtip issue, right?
Yeah, that's the wing warp. Wing warping. What happened was that what Curtiss came up with was a system that we still use today called ailerons. So instead of warping the wings, which if you think about it, once you move to metal airplanes, you can't exactly warp the wings. You can only do it with wooden fabric. Once ailerons were introduced, wing warping was obsolete. I mean, the irony, Bob, is that by the time Wilbur first demonstrated the Wright flyer in Europe in 1908, wing warping was effectively obsolete. But their patent... Back then, you could get something called a pioneer patent, which covered not just your invention, but everything like it. And what the Wrights said was that their patent on wing warping, which nobody used after a couple more years, covered ailerons as well under this pioneer concept because it controlled the lateral stability of the wings, which is what they called their wing warping, three-axis using a rudder. So the Wrights had a view of what the patent system, and we don't have that today. You can't. It's like if Bill Gates patented software for personal computers and tried to collect money from Steve Jobs for Apple software. We don't have pioneer patents, but that's what the Wrights were suing under. Mm-hmm.
And Curtiss, in the meantime, thought that these fundamental ideas were public domain. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, what he thought, he didn't think wing warping was public domain, but he didn't want to use it because it was an inferior system. What Curtiss believed and what we believe today is that you can patent a specific notion of how to do something, but you can't just patent something so general that anybody who does anything like it falls under your patent. And Curtiss was so advanced that he became the Wright's bete noir, and Wilbur focused on Curtiss. It's like Ahab and Moby Dick. Wilbur just was obsessed with Curtiss, and that's why after Wilbur died, in an article in the New York Times in February of 1913, Orville really did accuse Curtiss of killing his brother.
So you've already mentioned that there's no longer a pioneer patent, but I have to ask whether or not this whole issue of how patents impacted innovation as far as the Curtis and the Wrights are concerned. Is there a cautionary tale for today? What's the patent system look like today in your mind when you look back and see what havoc it seemed to create for these folks?
Well, that is a really good question. And when the book came out, I got a lot of inquiries from business organizations. The patent system is very, very tricky. Even the most ferocious advocates of free trade say, well, you need a patent system because you have to protect innovation. You have to protect an invention. You can't let somebody spend millions of dollars developing something and then build it and then have someone instantly steal it. On the other hand, a system that restricts innovation by keeping people from improving a product once it is on the market also stifles innovation. So what you need is a patent system that will protect people's research and people's expenditures and people's effort without stifling further innovation. And that is a very, very difficult and narrow road to walk. And the Apple-Samsung case was the one I was asked about the most. And there you have people arguing over the shape of the corner of an iPhone. So I think we clearly have a patent system now that imposes too many restrictions on people who wish to innovate and improve on products. But eliminating the patent system entirely, as some people have advocated, including Henry Ford, I think sounds great, but it would not be workable.
Now, in the case of the patent infringement lawsuit between Curtis and the Wrights, as it turns out, doesn't really make much difference what the courts decide, because in the meantime, World War I comes along, and explain how that impacts this whole issue.
Well, yeah, so the Wrights, actually, the great irony was that shortly after Wilbur died, the Wrights won their case, and then they won on appeal. But the problem was, well, there was two problems. First of all, when World War I came along and the United States entered, the government instituted cross-licensing, which meant that everybody's patent could be used by everyone else as long as you paid them a small amount on each aircraft. But even without the war, the victory, the Wrights victory in the patent suit would have been useless, because what Curtis learned, and probably from Henry Ford, was that all you need to do is to alter your design a bit, and the people who were suing you for patent infringement had to sue you all over again for that design. So you might lose each individual case, but you continue to sell your product while you're being sued, perhaps in perpetuity. Sure. And that is a real lesson for today also. There is no real way to impose discipline on people who are intent on producing a product similar to someone else's product. There are so many little ways around it that it is a waste of time and money in most cases to sue for infringement, unless you're suing someone small enough that you can run them out of business.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Lawrence Goldstone about his new book, Birdmen. The book is about the early years of manned flight and the fierce rivalry between the Wright brothers and Glenn Curtis, a clash that fueled the race to the skies. So your book also covers other earlier birdmen and their innovations, and you've already mentioned just briefly the role of the balloon. At one time, apparently, figured to be the future of aviators. Tell us about the balloon technology and where it was going right about the same time that Wilbur and Orville were doing their thing.
Well, balloons had been around since the Montgolfier brothers in the 1780s flew in France. And they were very popular, and people loved going up and looking down at the towns and woods and farms. The problem was you couldn't control them. So for about 100 years, there were two kinds of balloons. There were captive balloons, which you would have this really, really long rope, and the balloon would go up, and then they'd pull you down. And you had free balloons, which didn't have the rope, which people discovered to their chagrin could blow you anywhere, including over the ocean or the woods. And if the balloon lost air and you were in a disagreeable spot, the descent was not pleasant. The big problem was having a motor to be able to steer. And that dirigible means steerable. And in France, a young inventor who also was involved in powered flight named Alberto Santos Dumont supposedly came up with a way to power a balloon, and he flew one around the Eiffel Tower. But the real steerable balloon was not perfected until Captain Tom, as they called him, Captain Tom Baldwin, bought the Curtiss motor. And at a St. Louis World's Fair in 1904, it was for the centennial for the Louisiana Purchase a year late. And he flew a couple of miles and came back against the wind. And there were thousands of people watching, and the men threw their hats up in the air and the women cheered, because that was the first time you could power a balloon. And the Army became instantly interested, not as a weapon, but using the balloon for reconnaissance. But everybody kind of knew that if you could develop winged flight, it was going to be superior. Captain Tom was such a great salesman, though, that he almost convinced the Army that balloons were the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, he landed it on the White House lawn at one point, didn't he?
That was Lincoln Beachy.
Oh, okay.
Lincoln Beachy, for people who don't know him, with apologies to Chuck Yeager, was most certainly the greatest aviator who ever lived. He was called the boy aeronaut. When he was 18 years old, he was flying for Baldwin. And he flew around the Capitol in a balloon. And thousands of people went in the street. Congress adjourned. They went out on the lawn. Thousands of people went into the street to watch and were later wearing buttons that said, "Yes, I saw it." Beachy went, landed on the White House lawn. President Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, wasn't there, spoke to Mrs. Roosevelt, got back in the balloon, went back to Congress, and the Speaker of the House, Uncle Joe Cannon, adjourned Congress and gave Beachy lunch because it was such an amazing feat. This was in 1905. Mm-hmm. Beachy later flew around the Capitol in a fixed-wing aircraft in I think, 1911.
And he's the reason why I referred earlier in one of my questions to these innovators as weird birds, because I believe you say in your book that he actually dressed in drag when he'd go up in some of these escapades of his.
Yeah, well, he didn't. What he did was in Chicago, in the Chicago Air Show in 1912, he announced that he had trained a female aviator, Clarice Levasseur, who could fly every bit as well as a man. And sure enough, the megaphone man walks in front, announces Clarice Levasseur, and a short, stocky woman dressed in a long coat and a big hat comes out and gets in the airplane, and Beachy's airplane, and takes off. And first thing it does is buzz the crowd. It comes so close that the people have to duck. And then Clarice Levasseur, who clearly cannot fly at all, the airplane goes out over Michigan Avenue and flies so low that the wheels of the airplane were actually bouncing off the top of automobiles. And then Clarice goes in the air and starts in these wild gyrations, goes out over Lake Michigan, almost crashes four or five times, does this for about 10 or 15 minutes, and the crowd is just hoping this poor woman will come back alive. And then Clarice seems to get her bearings a little, does a couple of basic tricks, and makes a perfect landing in front of the crowd. And Clarice gets out of the airplane, whips off the hat, the wig comes with it, and there's Lincoln Beachy. He was so good that he could bounce his wheels on the top of automobiles and come within inches of the water and inches of the crowd and never hit anything.
Wow. How did all of these early aviators test their prototypes? I mean, obviously, reading your book, you learned that not all of them were successful in the testing phase. This was a risky business.
Oh, it was. In the first, I think, 5 years, effectively 5 years of flight, an aviator died about once every 10 days. It was, they were flying in open cockpits. There was no, they had no protection. They had no instruments. Initially, they had no seatbelts. A lot of the people died of the early fatalities were people falling out of airplanes. It took years, a couple of years before they figured out they should strap themselves in. Things broke, engines stalled, planes went into tailspins. It was a stunningly risky thing to do. And the people who did it were just like every other kind of pioneers, the people who went over the mountains. They were driven to do something that hadn't been done before. It was really a remarkable period. And it gives you a sense of Beachy that he was so much better than everyone else. It's just, you know, it's like Michael Jordan. You watch and you go, wow, he's terrific. But the other people, if you play basketball and you're really good and you realize how good the other people are and how much better Michael Jordan was than them, you get a sense of how much better Lincoln Beachy was than anyone in the air.
So if you try to draw a line to connect aviation today to the early pioneers, don't you really draw that line more to Curtis than you do the Wright brothers? I mean, isn't he put the company together?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Again, as I said earlier, the tragedy of the Wright brothers was that after Kitty Hawk, after December, there was not a single innovation that they introduced that was adopted by anybody. It was wing warping, and they also, Wilbur also figured out how to shape a propeller. Everything after that, Curtis introduced landing gear. He was the first man to take off from a ship, on an airplane, the first man to land on a ship. He invented the first hydroplane. He invented the steering wheel. He was the first person to use seats. Wilbur Wright was so brilliant that he clearly could have done just about anything to move aviation forward, and that he chose to spend his time micromanaging a patent suit. Bob, as good as he was as an innovator, he was that bad as a businessman.
I think it's interesting, and I'm anything but an expert in aviation in America, but I certainly, like everybody else on the planet, learned about the Wright brothers, and I learned about Lindbergh's trip across the sea. But here's Glenn Curtis, you tell us in your book, who completed the first true cross-country flight in the U.S. He did it with the full participation of the nation's largest newspaper. Boy, I don't ever remember. Maybe I missed something, but I don't ever remember reading much about him. He seems to be the guy that gets lost in history here.
Yes, and that is a tragedy all its own. Now, in fairness, Curtis's cross-country flight was only 150 miles. It was from Albany to New York City, which at the time was considered impossible. And he was almost thrown out of the airplane when he hit adverse air currents about three or four times. The first person to fly coast to coast was a man named Calbrafe Perry Rogers, Cal Rogers, who did it in 1911, I believe. And he flew from the Atlantic to Pacific. It took him months, and he had to stop because you couldn't get more than 100 or so miles in a day. But yes, Curtis, with all of these innovations, has been lost to history, and he has been overwhelmed by the mythology of the Wright brothers. And again, the Wright brothers deserve the accolades they received. There is no doubt about that. But to deify them and to pretend that they did something by themselves, which actually was done by many other people, is just incorrect, and it's bad history.
Well, Lawrence, you've done a great job of bringing Curtis to light for us, and most importantly, really giving us the behind-the-scenes story on this great achievement over the decades. We've run out of time, but I so much appreciate your joining us today at Reader's Corner, and most especially, I appreciate the fact that you've written the book, Birdmen, The Wright Brothers, Glenn Curtis, and the Battle to Control the Skies. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Lawrence Goldstone. Next week, Stephanie Witt, editor of Cities, Sagebrush, and Solitude, Urbanization and Cultural Conflict in the Great Basin. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Deborah Palmer. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. We invite you to follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Find us by searching for Reader's Corner.